Our discussion on politics in the media will be led by three persons who have very special qualifications in this field. The first is David Halberstam, the author of The Best and the Brightest and a student of power relationships existing in the news business, the news business and political institutions. The second is Nicholas Johnson, an outspoken critic of the media and a former federal communications commissioner. And the third is Sig Mikkelsen, past president of CBS News and a professor of journalism at Northwestern University. The first to speak will be David Halberstam.
Thank you, Harrison. And unaccustomed as I am to being sponsored by Yale University and Mobil Oil, I'm nonetheless delighted to be here. The subject is a very important one because I think we are living in an age comparable to a time at the invention of movable type. For better or for worse, most of what we know as political reality has been changed by the kind of overwhelming process of technological pressure, change. And I think the coming of the news shows and television and politics in general has changed us. We are not what we were, we are not what we are today, and it's going to change faster and faster. On the subject of the news shows, I think the first thing about them is very important, that for most of America, for the first time in their lives, there is a good front page. Maybe nothing much more, but a good front page nonetheless. There's not maybe a page two, and we maybe need, and sometimes I have a feeling that they raise as many questions as they answer. There's not enough context, not enough explanation, but the front page nonetheless. Although, as they say, if Moses handed down the Ten Commandments on the nightly news show, it would be said, Moses today gave the Ten Commandments, the two most important of which were. The second thing is that television, for better or for worse, has become a presidential vehicle. That has diminished the Congress, part of it the Congress's own fault, diminished the party system, and that the president, for a variety of reasons, has been able to make it his. He can go on it, whenever he wants, he can get access when he wants, he can travel and it will follow him, he can put his Ziegler or Nesson on, it is his vehicle to an astonishing degree, and we have yet to learn how to slow that down. And if we are going to balance out our democracy, it is terribly important that we begin to bring countervailing pressures through the medium which now has become his. And I don't think it's by chance that I think it has led to a sense of grandiosity in the last two presidents, and in fact helped to carry them to reach further than perhaps they might have. One other point I wanted to make, and that is, if the networks as they are now today are the prime source of news for Americans, then that is in many ways, no matter how good a show and how professional Cronkite and Chancellor and the men who work for them, that is in many ways a disturbing thing, because news is not the prime function of the networks. It is still about 5 or 7% of their reality. It is not like the New York Times, where the news and the judgment of news and the carrying of news is really, in effect, 95% of the raison d'etre. For the networks, it is really a small thing. In fact, mostly they think at the higher executive level, it is something that can only cause them grief and pain. So let me make those my opening remarks, and we'll be delighted to respond later to what you have on your mind.
Thank you, David. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. It's very difficult to pick one subject out of all that might be talked about in a period of 3 to 5 minutes. And what I'm going to try to do is tick off 15 areas that we might talk about during the course of this hour, and if any of you are interested in any of them, I'll be happy to explore them later. Let me say at the outset that with David, that the news is probably TV's finest hour, or half hour as the case may be, and I think when we tend to focus television criticism on news, we're really missing the mark. Nonetheless, there is tremendous power to the evening newscasts and television in general in shaping candidates, products, issues, governmental policy. Presidents watch the evening news programs and they shape their days in order to make the evening news programs. I think it is regrettable that that no network news executive was willing to appear on this show, although many were asked to do so. I think they are more sensitive than they need to be. Having said that news is the best thing that TV has to offer, however, does not exhaust the subjects that we might discuss about television news, and here are some. One, we can talk about the relatively little amount of time devoted to the news, the need for more regularly scheduled news, public affairs programs in prime time, and comparisons to other countries really put us to shame. Two, there have been some changes in entertainment programs. And just as we now talk about the mobile season on public broadcasting, I think Norman Lear has very nearly become entertainment programming in television, and that many of the more interesting discussions of public issues are to be found in some of his programs. Entertainment can be a format and sometimes an effective format for discussing issues. Third, the whole question of presidential control of television and the network's really indefensible posture, it seems to me. When the United States Senate asked for time on one occasion, the networks refused to sell time to a group of senators. Most recently, they said that two of them, that a senator couldn't have time to answer Ford's speech because it was not controversial, having earlier given in to his demands for time, presumably on the grounds that he had something of consequence to say. I would simply say the networks can't have it both ways. When senators of both parties complained about the failure to cover the Rockefeller hearings, Dick Saland of CBS, who was one of those invited to appear, accepted and subsequently declined, said, "We have an obligation to act solely on the basis of independent news judgment. And it's our independent news judgment that the Rockefeller hearings, the Senate hearings, should not be on." But when they acted on the basis of that wholly independent news judgment with regard to President Ford's speech to the future farmers, they concluded it was not newsworthy, and it got on anyway. And this is part of the imbalance in presidential and congressional approach to media that's so important, which raises the fourth point, a current proposal to televise Senate and House floor debate, which is something we can talk about. A fifth point is the relative failure of television to do investigative journalism, particularly, I say, as a former member of the Federal Communications Commission, their failure to cover the independent regulatory commissions and the scandal a day that is there to be told if only they would do the job of telling us. Sixth, we can discuss the extent to which television has not yet truly become visual. Most of what's on the television evening news is at best suitable for print. Some of it rises to the level of radio, almost none to the level of visual television. And I can document that with a study I recently did if you're interested in that. Seventh, the question of to what extent television does have the power to reveal the truth about a personality. Dick Saland, I will also quote him praise on this occasion, who asked the CBS radio affiliates, were we in fact telling the truth about Richard Nixon in 1972 when we contrast the way he was perceived by the American people then with the way in which he was perceived in 1974. Eight, we can always talk about local news, but I gather we're essentially avoiding that issue here today and emphasizing the networks, and indeed most of the local stations avoid it, so there's little to be said. Nine, Watergate illustrates I won't call it a bias, but a perspective of television journalism. TV and its advertisers are the principal problem today. I mean, it is television with $4.5 billion worth of commercial investment that is encouraging us to buy more to increase inflation, that is encouraging us to buy products that use up natural resources and scar the face of the earth, that is encouraging us to throw away products that could otherwise have been used, that is selling products that is dangerous to our health. So it is really at the core of what's wrong in the country today, and it's very difficult, therefore, for also to deal with it. We can talk about that at greater length. 10, the reporting of fads, for example, whatever happened to poverty. A report recently that in Nashville, 87% of the poor were without adequate medical care, 94% without adequate dental care, 95% have a nutritional problem, and 71% of these people are working. These are not welfare families. These are working families. Whatever happened to that story? 11, the story of the budget in the federal government is very seldom told in the way in which it should be detailed to the American people. 12, the overemphasis on disasters, wars, explosions, crimes of violence. Contrast that with page one of the Wall Street Journal or, say, the Des Moines Register, which happens now to be put together on page one by the same fellow who was putting together page one of the Wall Street Journal. 13, Washington and New York are equated with the United States when it comes to reporting the news. There are a lot of other communities about, and some of them deserve some reporting. Michael Novak, in an article that's been distributed to you here, I understand, let me read briefly two sentences. One, only a few Americans, national journalists among them, fly on airplanes, have expense accounts, are photographed with the glamorous and the powerful, bask in the corrupting glow of well-publicized success. One wonders, indeed, whose world is represented on television. It is no one's world. It is a fantasy, a report on no place. And we can talk about that some more. What is this no place, and how does it get on television? 14, the unwillingness to use others' material. Most recently, Frank Mankiewicz's interviews with Fidel Castro running over three nights in one day. It was unacceptable to CBS until Dan Rather had been down there for an hour or so doing the same thing himself, at which point they could use Mankiewicz's film. 15, the failure to cover some self-interest stories, such as most recently the license renewal legislation, one of the most preposterous pieces of legislation ever to go through the House and Senate, through the House by a vote of 379-14, through the Senate by a vote of 60-2, granting virtually licenses in perpetuity for broadcasters. Very little of that reported on the evening news. Well, that's a starter. There are more subjects, but if you're interested in any of those, we can pursue them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Mickelson.
You know, the last time I was in a program of this sort, I found that M was the top letter in the alphabet, and I was on with a couple of people whose names started with R and S, which means that I had to start the thing going and launch any controversy, which there might happen to be. This time, I thought it's a real break for me with a J and an H. I can follow through, and I'll have something to argue about. But I find, as I stand here now, that there really hasn't been very much controversy so far. So maybe I'm going to have to simulate any that there might be in this meeting. Generally, I've got to agree with the first two speakers that I think the thrust of the whole thing is that television news and its coverage of politics has generally done a fairly reasonable job. There are problems. There's the problem of the break which is given to the presidency over the Congress. There is the fact that television programs are too short to do much of anything. But generally, I think the feeling is that if television is doing anything well at all, the news is the best thing it's doing. Let me suggest, however, that there are a number of weaknesses which bother me. Weakness number one, no matter how much experience it's had, and this is a weakness of all of the media, the stress is always placed on the candidates and how are they doing. You know, are they going to win or are they going to lose? What kind of percentage are they going to have? And we don't really find out very much from any of the media what the voters are thinking about and what the voters are doing and where do they stand and what do they think of the candidates and why are they thinking as they do. A second problem, I think, with television news is the fact, and this is also a responsibility of the other media, there's too much emphasis on labels. You've got to put the label on with the Ten Commandments. So you say the two most important are so-and-so, and you label each one of them and go on without any explanation of it. The half hour is the problem, I suppose, of the television network news, and I think the rigidity of the local news, which has to be recycled on a five-minute unit, prevents local news from doing what I would like to see done. I get worried about the fact that the television broadcasters have a tendency to become the agenda setters in elections. The BBC is very cautious to stay out of agenda setting. It says we're here to cover. We're not here to describe, to define the issues, to identify them and get people arguing about them. And I think that perhaps is a weakness on the part of television news. I think there are a couple of other ones. I think the imbalance between the presidency and the Congress is a very, very serious one. Back at the time when I had some control over the situation, we had a press secretary in the White House, in Jim Haggerty, who was very interested in getting our reactions to it, and he would tell us in advance whether he thought it was important or whether he thought it was unimportant, and would give us some opportunity to make up our minds, and he generally had the feeling he didn't necessarily have to have simultaneous release. That's all gone down the drain since, and the president can demand time to make a speech to the future farmers in Kansas City. But I think there's one other problem that I find even greater than the others. Television has had an enormous influence, But I wonder what that influence is. 59% of the public, according to one of those pieces of paper you have higher regard or get more information from television news than from other sources. They have great confidence in it. But it seems to me that the essential difference in our political processes since the arrival of television, and let's call it 1952, has been on the form rather than the substance. The substance really hasn't changed much. We don't find any real evidence that there's been any influence. We thought so up to 1960 when we had a big turnout at the polls, 62.8% in 1960 and 1964 down to 61.8%, 1972 down to 55.7%. We expect on Tuesday of this week, 48 hours from now, to probably show the lowest record of public going to the polls that we've ever had. Television was supposed to overcome all this apathy. Television was to be the instrument that would get people interested, that would get them interested in issues, interested in candidates, and going to the polls in greater numbers than ever before. And I'm concerned that that has not happened. The form has changed, it's true, but I'm afraid that the principal criticism of television news at this stage has been that it hasn't really succeeded in creating a new political environment in which the candidates are more responsive to the public, and the public, in turn, has greater interest in the political processes and comes out and registers its opinions at the ballot box.
Thank you, Mr. Mickelson. I think I'll start this out with one question of my own to all three panelists. And it's a simple one. Who do you think would be the better man to present the news to the total public of the United States, Walter Cronkite or the editors of the New York Times? David?
Well, knowing the editors of the New York Times, which most of the young men and ladies in the audience don't, and thus giggling, I'm not sure. I do know the editors, and I trust Cronkite every bit as much as I trust most of the editors. I think he does as much spring from the country, and I think he has as much professional standard for what he does. His problem, to go back, as I said a moment, is that he has a page one. And as such, there's an inevitability to trivialize. A minute and a half. You cannot explain a complicated story in a minute and a half. It's like a grenade going off without any of the context. And there is the terrible problem of television, which is a bad story with good film will beat a good story with no film or with weak film. And it's a prisoner, not as Agnew said, of a liberal bias, but of a film bias, which is a very, very important thing. And since much of what happens in our life is not indeed on film, is beneath the surface, this is a great problem. But the failure of the networks themselves, who, after all, if they have this great prime response, if they are the prime carrier of news now, have to give us more. We live in a complicated world. The failure to have a half hour, perhaps at 10 to 10:30 or something like that, along the lines of a Today Show, where we can explore subtleties and diversity of viewpoint, where you're not compressing complicated situations into 2 minutes, that's very important. I will give you an example of what television doesn't do, and what the Times, Solzhenitsyn, which is an epical story of one man against the state, important at the highest level of intellect and important in human dimension. But no film. You can't go down to the KGB headquarters and film and interview the head of the KGB. You can't do Vox Pop on the streets with a Soviet citizen. No film there. You can't go out and, you know, easily film Solzhenitsyn himself at his house. So there's no film, there's no story. And that's the kind of thing where it fails. But in terms of what they do, I don't fault Cronkite's news and professionalism a bit.
Mr. Johnson, you want to say a word on that?
Yeah, I essentially agree with David on that. The TV journalists who I came to know in Washington, I would rank along with any print journalists or, for that matter, doctors or lawyers or any other professional group for as a capacity for ferreting out facts and reporting them fairly accurately. They do have a terrible problem. Walter Cronkite and others have characterized it. Most of them candidly concede that if you are dependent upon the network evening news, you are woefully uninformed. You simply must read a good newspaper, magazines, books, reports to know what's going on in the country today. You cannot rely on a few minutes of film splashed on the screen in the evening and consider yourself well informed. They know that. And yet at the same time, they have to recognize the fact that most of their audience is getting virtually all of their news from television. Therefore, they have to be the page one that David describes, with little spots of headlines that give you virtually no information at all except what topics are being discussed today in the newspapers and on the wire services.
Sick, do you have a worry?
Yes, I guess I still can't get into any controversy on this, and I hope you won't mind if I personalize just a little bit. I suppose I might have had a bigger hand than anybody in projecting Walter Cronkite into the position he's in today when I selected him to do the principal coverage for CBS News at the 1952 political conventions and the election the same year, and kept him in the same job through the duration of my time at CBS. I picked him for a number of reasons and had to argue with other people who wanted more show business type persons. And let me give you the reasons I picked him. In the first place, he was a good, hard-hitting, solid reporter with good experience. A first-class newspaper man with a lot of wire service experience. Secondly, he had a facility for being able to interpret what he saw and interpret the picture in a way I don't think Abe Rosenthal, the editor of the New York Times, would be able to do it. So he had that talent. A third talent he had was the fact that he kept on doing his homework. He wouldn't give up. He kept on being an enthusiastic reporter. Now, there's so many vast differences between the New York Times and television news that I think each needs its own talents and its own skills, and it seems to me that you really can't equate the two in any way whatsoever. And I have enormous confidence in Walter Cronkite, because for what he's doing, he is a superb newsman and a very, very skilled interpreter of the news for page one in television.
Let's go to the floor now and get some questions from our town meeting.
My name is Randy Bach, and I'd like to address a question to Mr. Johnson. He said that through a variety of reasons, mainly the fact that advertisers supply the money for TV, and TV media seems to pick out and choose the type of news that it likes to cover, that what you have is TV media shaping the news rather than purely commenting and observing it. And I'd like to know what type of solution you suggest for this problem, whether you think that the FCC should in some way regulate what comes over the airwaves. And if that is what you think, I was curious whether you think the FCC is itself an unbiased organization, and whether you think that any sort of intervention into television media would be a violation of freedom of the press.
Well, you've thrown me quite a number of questions there, along with some comments, most of which I would essentially support. The FCC has a pretty good record, in fact, on staying out of journalism questions. It refused to get into the charges that the networks had biased the coverage of the Democratic Convention or coverage of Nixon's speeches during Agnew's charges and so forth. And I think that's appropriate. I mean, I want the government in it, except to the fairness doctrine. And I think that that too has been, while not a perfect solution, has worked fairly well. I'm not charging that sponsors are keeping information off the air. I think that most responsible journalism organizations have at one time or another reported on some of these issues. But I do think that we get less emphasis upon the power of big money in America, the role of the top 100 corporations in shaping the national agenda and national policy, the role of the oil companies in shaping energy policy, then I think we really ought to get, just in fairness in terms of telling the story. The failure to cover the regulatory commissions is only one example of that. And I mentioned the fact that television is, as I say, I think one of the principal problems when we talk about the wastage involved in throwing away some 71 billion cans a year and 38 billion bottles and 8 billion pounds of plastic and 70 billion pounds of paper. And so it's television that sold those products to us.
And I think there is an inherent conflict whenever you have commercial interests dictating the nation's largest and most powerful stage, lecture hall, whatnot, and that's the case today.
I want to go to the floor again for another question.
My name is Bruce Burke, and I kind of wonder about the whole notion of the fairness doctrine. As I understand it, the fairness doctrine tends to apply to hard news broadcasts. And it seems to me that while the fairness doctrine to apply to editorial type content would in fact be a wise thing, considering the immediacy of the impact and the availability to other speakers outside of those representing the network organizations, it seems to me questionable for the various networks to be monitored by either private organizations or others as to the fairness content of their hard news broadcasts. Now, I was wondering what each of the speakers would think about the abolition of the fairness doctrine as it concerns hard news.
Sig, do you want to address yourself to that?
Yeah, I think the fairness doctrine is about as required for the human being as a tail, which we long since got rid of when we quit living in trees. I think as long as our broadcasting is operated on the basis of a trusteeship principle, which was written into the Federal Radio Act in 1927 and into the Federal Communications Act in 1934, that the licensing process in itself is quite adequate to keep a reasonable degree of fairness as long as the broadcaster is a trustee of the public interest. On the other hand, I think it's a very dangerous commodity, as Mr. Whitehead tried to use it in a speech out in Indianapolis in 1973 when he suggested that this was a wedge, a weapon that the local stations could use to force the networks to knuckle down with their news broadcasting. And I think it's a very dangerous weapon, and I would like to see it eliminated, and I'd like to see us go back to where we were before 1949 and operate on the trusteeship principle and maintain our fairness on that basis.
David, you have a word.
Well, I'd like to add that because it seems to me that there's a tendency on the part of the networks to finally use the fairness doctrine as one more reason to abdicate responsibility, not to take on things, but the fairness doctrine, and to go back to a previous question about the role of advertisers, it's again a reason to abdicate. You are charged, I think, with doing documentaries, with bringing the wisdom and intelligence of your staff to longer periods. You don't go into controversy because the advertisers don't want it. Advertisers don't want controversial subjects. Therefore, the advertisers don't sponsor it. Therefore, we don't do the important documentaries that we should. I mean, here are these brilliant staffs, this terrific library of film, and we are getting nothing in the way of those longer, insightful looks that we should get. I mean, we get occasionally 60 minutes, which is brilliant, but is not nearly enough. And the networks take the ball, and they place it back to the advertisers in this area.
Let's go to the floor again for another question over here.
My name is Hugh Williams. I'd like to address my question to Mr. Johnson. You mentioned something about spectacularism in the news, and I was curious to know how you changed the structure of news programming so as to de-emphasize this sensationalism.
A lot of it is simply in terms of how you define news. There was an article a couple years ago by Max Ways and Fortune to the effect that it used to be the news was something that was played out in front of a curtain that was fairly fixed. And nowadays, he made the point, it is the curtain itself that's constantly changing. I think the journalism schools have frankly not caught up with the changes in society and the needs for different stories to be perceived as news. So part of it is that. That's related to the inclination of the networks to view everything that's going on as America as equivalent with the things that are going on in Washington and New York that their friends are engaged in. There are a lot of other stories in the country than that. It's also a function of a failure, I think, to use adequate amount of imagination as to how to cover stories. As I mentioned, the fact is that 90% of what's on an evening news program is radio at best. A very little of it is television in the sense of bringing you something on film that you could not otherwise have come to understand. Those are three examples, briefly.
Sig, you have a point
there? Yeah, I want to cut in on that one. I just don't believe the television is not doing news that is not inherently pictorial. When we first started out in this business in the early 1950s, we had to subscribe to a news service in order to get film, and it was absolutely great at delivering dog and pony acts and monkey acts and a fire now and then if it were a big enough fire. We had to dedicate all of our time to, or much of our time, to trying to find out how you can take an abstract topic and a very difficult non-pictorial topic and create something out of it which becomes reasonably honest television news. And I think a lot of thought has been given to that, and I think, for example, that in all that Watergate coverage that the television networks were furnishing, that was not a pictorial story. It was a story they had to do without pictures. I remember CBS News, just before the 1972 election, did a two-part takeout on the Russian wheat deal. There wasn't very much pictorial about that, but they did, by the use of talent and ingenuity, find a way to make that story interesting and make a television story out of it. So I deny that television is shying away from anything that doesn't have an obvious pictorial aspect to it.
David?
Well, I would like to dissent a little bit from Sig, because I know the wheat deal story he's talking about, and it's an absolute journalistic tour de force, but it's also very much an exception. And it was a Stanhope Gould, very talented guy, and they put it together and they had the time. But it's the kind of thing that television all too rarely does. And I must tell you that my own experience of Vietnam and with these guys out there who are your colleagues from CBS or NBC, they are very good. And they're trying to get the more subtle, more complicated stories back. And they finally talk the New York office into getting away from what we used to call bloody or bang bang. And they finally go down, do some complicated stories, say, down in the Mekong Delta, and they'd come back, and that day the opposition would go out and have a terrific battlefield story, which may or may not have explained anything, and they'd get a rocket from the Home Office saying, you know, how come NBC got bloody and bang bang, and we got, you know, somebody talking down there in the Delta? And it is a problem of television news, which is distinctive from newspapers, and that is, there are things called ratings, and it is competitive for ratings, and it does affect the dramatic thing, and I think it somehow does tend to affect, finally, the very good people they have in the field, and it does make a difference.
Let's go to the questioner over here.
My name is John Gabrielli, and I'd like to ask Mr. Mickelson, how do you balance the recently celebrated right of privacy for Americans with the need to know and the need for appropriate television film to uncover and investigate stories they feel are the American public should know about?
Well, I think that what you've got to do, of course, is define the right of privacy pretty completely, make it a rather sharp definition. It seems to me that when you're dealing with problems of government, that there can be much more latitude vis-a-vis the right of privacy, because people who are in government have projected themselves into a position where they lose some of that right of privacy which they otherwise would have. And it seems to me that the only way that you can dig out a Watergate story is by taking some liberties with the right of privacy of people who are some way involved in a story of major national importance. I, on the other hand, with respect to the private individual, would give him all the protection in the world and try as hard as it possibly can be done to avoid that type of invasion. Investigative reporting, of course, is something else. When there is reasonable reason to think that some person is engaged in some illegal activities which the public should know about, then again, I would have to say that the right of privacy has got to be treated with some relaxation.
Let me put a footnote to that, Sig. When Wilbur Mills was coming home with the Argentine firecracker and was stopped by the park police, a very alert TV cameraman or crew got on the scene and took some pictures of Mr. Mills during the course of his discussion with the police officers. Do you think this was a legitimate news operation, or was this violating Mr. Mills' right of privacy?
I think in view of the fact that Mr. Mills is one of the three or four or five or six most powerful people in government, and in view of the fact that he was engaged in a political campaign in the state of Arkansas to get himself reelected, that I would probably, if I'd had to make that decision, made the decision to go ahead and use it.
Any disagreement?
Well, I don't, I mean, not so much on the Mills thing, but I think, you know, that I've invaded people's privacy all the time, but they're public figures. If I had gone to the sainted Robert McNamara back when he was the poet laureate of the Ford Motor Company and implored him to give up that job and go to Washington to save our Defense Department, he said, no, I just want to stay here and make little cars, I'd feel very guilty about penetrating his privacy and showing him out to be perhaps less than the public servant than he wanted to be. But since he, of his own volition, went into the pit and liked the glory, the glamour, the power, I think those people are fair game for us. And they, you know, I don't really know that there are innocent bystanders.
Let's go down to the floor for a question.
I guess I'm addressing not so much yourselves, because I think I'm addressing the issue of the national town meeting more. It seems to me this is a very good representation of a national town meeting and how they were in the very beginning. It's advertised as a town meeting. It's basically all Yale students here, the elite. It's also, this section was reserved for the Yale Political Union. I'm not part of it, but I acted very dumb, and of course I got in. And then, see, I live outside the community of Yale here, and we experience things a lot different than you experience things here. And I'm going to use this media to try to communicate that. The Yale image that was presented in the very beginning, that's not how we experience Yale if you don't go to Yale. I experience Yale up at Edgewood Park area of town, where there's a Yale Bowl there, and there's a quiet park there in this city of New Haven. We try to go there to have some peace of mind, but this Yale Bowl is blowing away on weekends, where it's the last warm weather we have to be in the park. It's the same way with the New York Giants. It's the same way with in Edgewood Park, one of our decent parks. Yale, with one trip of Pan Am Airlines, has got together to build this thing, the International Rowing Course Foundation, this front group, to build this rowing course through our park. You know, and we live there. The people didn't want this stuff. But, you know, but of course, Yale and the city, they all work hand in hand very comfortably. They enjoy each other.
You know, but, excuse me, this is very interesting, but
it's
do you
very
really
interesting,
have a question?
But this, no, it's very interesting, exactly. I'll finish up with 15 seconds.
Let's have the question.
Maybe it's a question to everyone here. That's the other part of the thing. Is a town meeting, how is a meeting constructed? Is it constructed with the authorities and those who obey, which is the way our elite economy is set up, or do we stand up and begin to talk to each other? Because, like, you know, we're the people just as much as they are, and I respect your opinions and we've learned, but we don't get a chance to get our viewpoints across. What we feel as everyday people in the streets, what we're living. And we have to use these things, because if we don't, I mean, it's art. All it is a stick. You talk to it. We're just talking our feelings. That's all it is.
Well, I think, if you excuse me, that you've had an opportunity to make your point, and if anyone on the platform wants to comment on it, Mr. Johnson.
I'd like to comment on it, because I think it's quite a relevant point of view, and it's something that's not represented here, except in this speaker who snuck in unobserved into our midst. The subject to which he addressed himself was also addressed in an article which you found on your seats when you arrived by Michael Novak, entitled Why the Working Man Hates the Media. And I think the fellow who just spoke is echoing much of what Michael Novak was trying to say in his own way, which is, and I will say that it was echoed by the, I just having concluded a congressional primary race in the state of Iowa, my home state, where I spent 6 months talking to some sampling of 480,000 people out there, a point of view that is widely held throughout the United States and that does need to be addressed by the media and does need to be addressed by Yale and does need to be addressed by public broadcasting. And that is that the slice of life from which we come and the slice of life we report is almost totally irrelevant to 95% at least of the American people, who are into a wholly different set of issues, most of whom have never been on an airplane, let alone spending most of their lives on airplanes, most of whom earn well under $15,000 a year instead of 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 times that amount. And I think that when there is talk of the Eastern establishment, when there is talk of the liberal bias in the media, I think that is what Michael Novak is telling us. That is what's really being communicated. It's not so much liberalism.
It's not so much Eastern, because most of the network evening newscasters don't come from the East. They come from Harry Reasoners from Iowa and so forth. But they do represent an elite, and they are talking about another elite. And in Washington, as you sit there and you watch the evening newscast, it strikes you very much as closed-circuit television. It's all the fellows who were at the cocktail party the night before talking to each other, the correspondents and the politicians. And then the next day they go out and they interview each other. And then that night they get on TV and they all sit around and watch each other. I'll never forget the shocking experience of watching the evening news from Indianapolis, Indiana. It was a wholly different experience. It was the first time I really realized that this stuff's going out all over America and everybody's watching our little show.
I couldn't disagree more with Nick. I think to sit here and to say that the men who put together those evening news shows, to the limits they are, don't understand what are of issue to people out there, if we're going to use the phrase out there, that the war was not an issue, or the protest against the war was not an issue out there, or the question of economy or the question of race, which television has covered pretty well, I think it's just wrong. I mean, I think they are issues. We don't do them well enough. We don't have enough time. But I don't underestimate the intelligence of people out there. I do not underestimate their thirst for more and better knowledge, the rising level of sophistication. They may resent us as reporters. They damn well, everybody else does. Presidents and politicians do. Blacks do. Why shouldn't the blue-collar people resent us? We're a very resentable profession if we do our job right. But I think if you are saying that 95% of what we do is irrelevant, you're really wrong.
Well, I think your very itemization of issues, David, makes my point. You're talking about things like recognition of red China and inflation in the broadest sense and so forth. Most of the fellows who are on the evening news shows, whether being interviewed or doing the interviewing, are simply not confronted with problems of, you know, trying to find a parking place in downtown Washington, going to the supermarket and buying groceries, trying to find a decent place to live, trying to feed a family on $9,000 a year in New York City. Those are problems that a president who earns $200,000 a year and a network evening news commentator who earns $300,000 a year just don't have much day-to-day contact and experience with, and those are the issues. I didn't find when I went door-to-door in the 3rd District of Iowa that many people approached me that the most important problem to them was Watergate or recognition of China or inflation in the sense of what East Coast banks are now charging as the prime interest rate. That wasn't what was prime on their minds. They're engaged in day-to-day life and problems, and there's a lot of news out there, and Charles Kuralt's the only guy reporting it.
Why should news necessarily be a reflection of day-to-day life? I mean, you could have done a brilliant goddamn job of covering Hitler's Germany from the day-to-day life of people there. Meanwhile, the state was being taken over by the Nazi government. We were very lucky that the networks did Watergate to the degree that they did do it, because it was an attempt at a two-day talk. And I mean, it's very easy. I mean, I don't think the evening news show should have to be necessarily a reflection of the day-to-day. Obviously, there should be a ventilation, and people get an airing of their problems. It should be broader. We need more times that people can talk about things that mean something to their lives. But and Watergate's a very good example. Maybe those people didn't think it was relevant to their lives, and maybe the networks didn't do as good a job as making them visualize what that threat to freedom of speech was in their terms of local police and mayor and sheriff, what it would have meant in their community. But it was a terribly, terribly important moment in this country's history.
Don't leave the suggestion that I'm opposed to Watergate coverage. I think there ought to be more exposés, not less. Nor am I saying that 5% elite in America should not control 95% of the evening newscasts. I'm just saying they shouldn't control 100% of it. That's all.
Let's go down to the floor and take a question.
My name is Eugene Meyer. I'd like to ask in relation to Watergate, what the gentleman on the left said. Is the role of television to choose what issues the American people have to know about, whether they want to know about them or not?
Inevitably, it has to be.
Well, we're dealing with something quite extraordinary, because for the first time, journalism has always been, in effect, an elite profession. It is an elite profession because you're using your critical facility at your best. You are subjective. Harrison Salisbury, who is our moderator tonight, is one of the great reporters of our time because he was a very brilliant subjective journalist in many ways. But the New York Times has always had a constituency that paralleled its reporters. What is unique about the evening news, and this is what makes it so powerful and so extraordinary in our lives, is that you have an elite makeup and outlook going into a mass base for the first time, and that's a quantum jump in the way we live.
Well, let me mention one issue here that I don't think the networks created as an issue, and that is the whole question of the availability of food and the prices of food and the relationship of food to inflation. That is an issue, and it's an issue which I think the networks have been covering with a good deal of skill and a good deal of resourcefulness. And I think it's also something which illustrates the fact that the networks are not one-man bands with a Walter Cronkite sitting in New York in his ivory tower, which is actually on the second floor of an old milk barn on West 57th Street, and making up decisions which are, if then thrust upon, the whole public. Rather, there are reporters and correspondents who are out in the field, and these correspondents are reflecting what is happening out in the field. And I think the coverage of this inflation and food issue has been a good example of the fact that they are responsive to issues as they arise.
Well, Sigmund, you know, I mean, in fairness, that these stories that get covered are decided in New York, not in the field.
Sure, they're decided in New York.
I mean, you know that famous story of the fellow in Vietnam, and David may know this himself, who took pictures of American troops in Cambodia, sent it back to New York. It didn't appear on the evening news. He asked why. He said, well, the New York Times hasn't reported it yet. We can't get home.
I doubt this.
The networks were offered the Pentagon Papers long before they appeared in the newspapers. The networks refused to put them on the air. I mean, there's story after story like that. I think that, in fact, the direction is coming out of New York, and you who were providing it ought to know that best of all.
And I think the direction in New York is very responsive to what good correspondents out in the field are recommending to New York. And, of course, war stories are quite something else again. You really can't equate war stories with stories of the economy or stories of taxation.
Let's go to the floor.
My name is Ruth Elliott. I was wondering if any or all of you could comment on the disproportionate quantity of national as opposed to international news on the 30-minute evening news.
David?
I think it's a terrific point. I mean, I would agree. And the question again is, because it is it's the kind of thing that they don't do well, and it's because I think the editors have a sense of what their mass audience is and how much it will absorb. And I think they just have decided that what happens in Europe or Germany or the Soviet Union, Poland is, by and large, not important enough. That audience out there, in fact, will only absorb so much. It's one of the things that they do very poorly right now. It's one of the areas where they genuinely fail.
But, of course, today we have only international stories. I mean, if the ozone disappears because of the aerosol cans, it disappears all around the planet. And that goes for, you know, pollution of all kinds, use of natural resources, inflation, food problems, the forthcoming starvation of 50 million people, and so forth. And I think there is a failure to cover news from the planet that we all live on that can be seen most dramatically by watching the evening news in Tokyo or London or Europe. There is more news of the United States on NHK in Japan every day than there is on any one of the three American commercial networks. And there is also news about Japan and about Europe and about other places around the world. I think we do have a provincial view of our own self-importance and that it does us a disservice as a people.
Let's go to the floor over here.
Yes, my name is Stephanie Vardavis. This is something you all touched on earlier, and I'd sort of like to explore it a little more. There was a recent commentary on WCBS radio talking about how whenever President Ford asks for primetime network coverage, even if it's just to talk to the future farmers of America, whether it's a landmark address or not, he can always get it. And I was wondering how you would propose to limit or ration the amount of primetime coverage that a president is entitled to from the networks.
Sig?
Well, that is a very difficult question to answer. The trouble is, again, that the newspapers are in a position to make their own decisions completely independently of whatever the White House may think or want to do. As long as that licensing club is held over the heads of the broadcasters in the United States, they do feel some kind of responsibility simply for the maintenance of their licenses to respond to heavy pressures when they're imposed by the White House. I think it's too bad that it has to be that way. I wish that they were in a position to stand up and reject a request when they think it's out of order to accept that request. I think they could exercise more independence of judgment, and I think they could make their decisions a little more vigorously, a little more affirmatively if they actually were to go ahead and do it. But as long as that licensing factor is there, you always are wondering whether somebody's license is going to be in jeopardy, and I think that's too bad.
I also think it's nonsense. The network has never lost its license, probably never will. Very few of anybody else lose them. I mean, a small fraction of 1/100 of 1% of the nation's broadcasters have ever been in trouble. On those occasions when these issues have arisen at the FCC, the record is very clear that it has not interfered in these kind of journalistic judgments, and it's publicly proclaimed itself on numerous occasions in that fashion. I think the answer to this is very simple. You treat the President of the United States like you treat a senator, who also presumably has some licensing power over the network, since the FCC is supposed to be an arm of Congress and independent of the executive branch of government. You treat him the same way. Anytime the president wants to go into his little TV studio and record him a program, you let him do it. And then you look at the tape. And if he says that the Russian missiles are going to arrive in 15 minutes, you break into your primetime schedule and you put it on, presumably. But if what he has to say is of less earth-shattering significance, figuratively and literally, you put it on at some other time. Maybe you put it on at 11 and 12 o'clock at night when you put on the other serious discussions of social issues. Maybe you break it up and you put 30 seconds worth of it on the evening news like you do for the Senate and the House when they want to respond to the president. I think the answer is very simple, and as a former FCC commissioner, I think that would be the appropriate answer. And from my conversations with members of the White House Corps, representatives of the networks who were there on the job, that's the way they think it ought to be handled, but network management doesn't see it that way.
David. Well, maybe you then, or else you could find out, if you're going to give him the 30 minutes, find out whatever senator from the opposition party bugs him the most and give him equal time, and I think you'd find the president beginning to ask for less and less time. But it's a very important point, because what we have is really a presidential vehicle, an almost an unwritten constitutional amendment, electronic amendment to the Constitution, where the president can parachute into home after home, 60 million homes, nobody checks him. It's why Dan Rather was so important, because he finally became, as the party system was diminished, as the congressional system, he became the proxy opposition. He was the one man standing between the president and you and watching him and keeping him checking. We are really very much in his debt that he did it as well as he did.
Yeah, look what we did to him. We got rid of him.
There's been the statement and the implication all through today that the New York Times is an example of clear objectivity as opposed to the networks. What I think there's an important point here. The difference, perhaps, is not so much that one is objective and one is not objective, but we're more sophisticated as far as newspapers are concerned, and we know that there is a bias where when we see a picture, we tend to think that pictures can't lie. There is an advantage also in the newspapers that we can choose, let's say in New York, we can go to the New York Times, New York Post, the Daily News, the Village Voice, all different kinds of viewpoints. But the networks all have, as Mr. Halberstam stated, they really don't have any constituency at all. They don't have any particular viewpoint, and they try to get a universal viewpoint.
Could we have the question quickly, because we're running out of time?
All right. The question is, the disadvantage, how can we deal, or how can the disadvantages of the networks, that they have no constituency, be dealt with without going to the kind of journalism that we have in the local news, just the palsy-wowsy laughing about the news?
I'm terribly sorry I have to cut off your question without an answer, because we have run out of time, and we're going to have to bring this session of our national town meeting, which comes to you from New Haven, Connecticut, to an end. We want to thank our audience here of Yale University students and some others, and also those who are with us on radio and television. We invite you to be with us next week when our town meeting will come from Washington, D.C., and our topic will be New Trends in Politics. Thank you very much.